Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable, hosted by Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Dorothy is a nationally recognized benefits and compliance consultant and group health broker. Here, you'll listen to industry experts break down the latest news and trends in employee benefits, healthcare reform, regulations and compliance, all designed to empower executive decisions.
Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable. I'm your host, Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting, and I want to welcome my guest today, Sue Wakamoto Lee, our new Director of Business Development for Advanced Benefit Consulting, and of course, Marilyn Monahan, our attorney from Monahan Law Office. Welcome, ladies, and thank you for being here.
I'm very pleased to be joining you and Sue here today.
I'm excited to be here, but albeit in a slightly different role.
Of course you will be. So as some of our listeners will remember, I've interviewed Sue on the Benefits Executive Roundtable a few times before as a guest, as a representative of the California Agents and Health Insurance Professionals, CAHIP. And this past fall, we recorded on the use of HRAs to save money. It's nice to have you back, Sue. And this time, it's really great to have you as an addition to our ABC management team. How does it feel to be back on the broker consultant side of things after being on the general agency side for a while?
Well, yeah, I'm absolutely thrilled. It's been my passion over the decades to help employers and their employees. So it's fulfilling to be able to be back in that role and dealing directly with employers again. And I don't know, does everyone listening know what a general agent is?
No, we did talk about it before when you were our guest before, but why don't you explain that so people understand the difference?
Yeah, I was going to say, in case you're worried that I've been out of the market, actually, I haven't been. I've actually been in the employee benefits market. A general agent's a little different. If you're a larger employer, you may not be familiar with the GA and the benefits world, but they basically act as a conduit between brokers and carriers. And of course, brokers like us, like Dorothy and I, have direct relationships with carriers. But in the smaller group arena and a little bit in the large group arena too, GAs can provide almost like a support structure for a broker. They write such large volumes of business, especially in the small group arena, that sometimes they have leverage that an individual broker might not be able to utilize. And they also can all offer support, transactional support. So you may actually, if you're a smaller employer listening to us today, you may not realize that your coverage may have been written by your broker through a GA because the service you're receiving is seamless. So there's definitely pros and cons to using a GA, and we can talk about that another time. But again, for me, it's great to be back in touch with employers directly because of the ability to assist and to support. But I would say that now that I'm working with Dorothy and excited to do so, it doesn't mean that I won't be using a general agent. There may be instances where it's the most prudent thing to do. And as an employer, you probably should know if your broker is using one.
Yeah, for sure. And it is an important thing for people to understand. And a lot of people wouldn't because, again, all they see is the end product, right? And as an example, when you were in the GA business, you guys actually sometimes did enrollment support and everything else for the brokers, particularly, I would imagine, for the smaller brokers that really don't have any support staff. A lot of times you'd send your own people out to help with enrollment meetings and things like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially like for bilingual support or even some compliance support, since, you know, that's my wheelhouse and my passion. I helped brokers with that quite a bit. So sometimes if you have a broker that isn't quite as knowledgeable, they may appear more knowledgeable because they do have a good general agent that they're working with. Oh, and one important thing to note, if you do find out your broker is working with a GA, don't worry, it's not affecting your rates. Just want to make that clear.
Yeah, all the rates are flat standard across the board. So thanks for clarifying that. And by the way, just for the listening audience, I like to refer to Sue as a mini me as far as her skill level and her, you know, her background and things like that. And we laugh about it because I know very few people that are actually shorter than me, and Sue's one of them. Yeah. So I can actually say that. But anyway, the bottom line is she is like me, and she mentioned the compliance and the things like that. And one of the reasons that we brought you on here, of course, is because of your compliance background and your interest in education and compliance and things like that. So it was a really, really good fit. So anyway, sorry, we kind of digress, but that's okay. We do that sometimes here. Of course, we've had Marilyn on many times over the past 5 seasons, and we're always happy to have her on because our audience just absolutely adores her. So thank you again, Marilyn.
You're so kind, Dorothy. I do always enjoy these opportunities to chat with you and your guests in these roundtables. It's an excellent opportunity to combine a discussion of important and emerging topics with real-world administrative challenges, as well as solutions.
Well, thank you, Marilyn. Before we get into the meat of this discussion today, I do want to apologize to our listeners for the delay in launching the second half of our Season 5. It was supposed to start back up on January 16th, as those of you that have been listening for a few years now, we always start back up after the holidays in mid-January. But I have to tell you that the reason it was delayed is because yours truly had laryngitis. It was not because of a writer strike or an actor strike or anything like that. It was simply because I had laryngitis. So it's hard to record a podcast when you have laryngitis, right? And imagine somebody like me that does basically speaking for a living, whether it's, you know, working with our clients or doing compliance, doing webinars, doing seminars, speaking at events, recording podcasts, you know, you have to have your voice. So that's why it was delayed. And I do want to apologize. It started over New Year's weekend and it got progressively worse. And I was actually on complete vocal rest for almost a week. And I was really worried because Marilyn and I had a speaking engagement. We were on a panel for an industry organization, an association that Sue and I belong to, our local chapter. And that was on January 9th on a Tuesday. And I was so paranoid that I was not going to have a voice. And as Marilyn can attest, I was there on the panel, but I had to have a microphone and I was speaking very softly, which is not like me, right? I'm usually able to project pretty well. And I was just so relieved that I was only one of three panelists and could grab the mic every time I needed to speak because I didn't have much of a voice. But, you know, I got through it with tea and hot tea with lemon and honey, and just we were able to get through it. So that's great. It's been about 3 weeks now, and I'm actually about 85 to 95% back, depending on the time of the day and what I've been doing that day. So we're ready to begin this next part. And you know what? By the way, I want to mention this because, you know, one of the worst things about having laryngitis is when you're in your car. I don't know about you guys, but when you're in your car, I like to listen. I do one of two things. I'm a multitasker, right? Everybody knows I'm a multitasker. Sometimes I'm doing 10 things at once. But when I'm in the car, for the most part, I'm on the phone. You know, communicating with somebody, coordinating something, doing something. Can't do that when you have laryngitis. So the next thing I like to do when I can't talk on the phone, bad signal, whatever, is sing along to my favorite songs on Sirius Radio. And that's not a plug, but that's what I do. And I have to say, I don't have a singing voice. I leave that up to Sue. She has a beautiful singing voice. But I do like to sing. And I have to tell you, for the first time in 3 weeks, last night, I was on my way to the Anaheim Ducks game. Those of you that know me well know that I'm a season ticket holder. Sorry, another shameless plug, I suppose. But the bottom line is I love to sing, and especially certain types of music, and Rob Thomas is one of my all-time favorites. I got to sing on the way to the Ducks game last night, Matchbox 20's Don't Get Me Wrong, in the car for the first time in 3 weeks. That's an amazing thing for me, and I know it's kind of a personal thing, but it just made me feel great. Because you ever try to sing when you have laryngitis, even partial laryngitis? Like one out of every five or six words might come out of your mouth, and it sounds very eerie and very weird. Anyway, it was just one of those situations. So, and by the way, Sue sang the national anthem at an industry event on Monday when we were there, and she did an amazing job. And dummy me, she asked me to record, and I was thinking she's singing, so I did a voice record instead of a video record from my phone, but someone else did it. So eventually you guys will probably hear. I may sneak in a snippet from time to time on some of our work at ABC. So anyway, just to embarrass you a little bit, Sue.
Thanks, Dorothy. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, she's a beautiful voice. Not like me, but she's actually very, very good at it. But you did a beautiful job, by the way. So again, my apologies. Sorry I took so much of your time by going into that, but I just wanted to explain why we were late in getting the second half of the season started. So, but I guess some of the listeners will get to know me a little bit better now today, because I don't usually talk about personal things too often. So now you know I like to listen to music in my car, and I like to sing along to the songs on the car and on the radio. And so if you're driving alongside next to me, you'll know if you see me. I may not always be on the phone. I may be singing. Anyway, so I asked you guys here to join me today to talk about the employer selection of a benefits broker and consultant, and to provide sort of a checklist that people can use in selecting a broker and consultant, because this is such an important part of an employer's benefit team. I like to think of us as a part of their benefit team, by the way. Brokers and consultants, if they're doing their jobs correctly, they should have regular contact with especially the mid-sized to larger group, but at least monthly contact, I would think, for smaller groups. Do you guys agree with that?
Well, you know, Dorothy, I think when we're talking about smaller employers, It could be more, it could be less, and I'll tell you why. One of the universal characteristics I've noticed in the small groups, small employers that I've worked with, is that they don't typically have a dedicated human resources specialist and don't even think about an HR department. They wouldn't have one. And so most of them utilize an HR consultant or some type of independent contractor, even a service, rather than having a full-time HR specialist. So what that means is, those instances, they aren't skilled. It isn't their everyday duty to, you may be talking with the office manager, and it's not their everyday duty to do benefits. They've got lots of other things they're responsible for in that business. And so they end up having a lot of day-to-day transactional needs. And, honestly, you'd be surprised at some of the employers I've worked with that you think would have been large enough to have an HR specialist, but they didn't. And so however, a knowledgeable and innovative broker can provide their clients with self-service tools that will help them provide solutions with a short turnaround time. The broker should be clear also, I would say, about expectations. So while self-service tools may be good for transactional type of, ads and deletes and things like that, if it's more strategic or compliance related, the employer needs to understand what their broker's capabilities are in that area. So there should be some clear expectations set about that relationship and how often the broker is available and what type of contact is necessary. Because, I think we both know, we all know actually, that there are different employers that have employees with different aptitudes. And so it's really based on the relationship you have between the broker and the employer as to what type of service, how often, and what level.
Well, Dorothy, I think you've suggested a very fair approach, and I agree with Sue's comments on in what circumstances and what type of employers might need what level of help. Each group is going to be different, and some will require more time, some less, and it's all going to depend on the makeup of their workforce, the experience of their executive team with benefits, and the scope of claims and administrative issues that tend to come up on a daily, weekly, monthly basis.
Before we get into some of the specifics on broker services and selecting a broker, I'm going to start with you, Marilyn. There are some legal and some regulatory considerations when it comes to selecting a broker. Marilyn, let's start with the fiduciary rules under ERISA, those that point to a process of selecting a broker consultant, as well as other vendors that are used in the administration of their health plans. What do you think?
Well, under ERISA, and that is the federal law that governs private sector health and welfare plans, the employer, as the plan administrator, has certain fiduciary responsibilities when administering the benefits that are subject to ERISA. Benefits subject to ERISA include major medical, dental, vision, life, and more. Part of the employer's fiduciary responsibilities require the employer to select as well as monitor service providers to ensure that the service provider is, among other standards, providing reasonable services at a reasonable cost. The Department of Labor, the Federal Department of Labor, has issued guidance on this topic generally. It's a booklet entitled Understanding Your Fiduciary Responsibilities Under a Group Health Plan. This brochure includes a discussion of steps an employer should take when selecting as well as monitoring a service provider.
Can you expand on some of the requirements for employers when making a selection just to get us started? You and I know, have discussed this at length with our DOL EBSA 2021 guidance on cybersecurity that was released. We had webinars and so forth on that, which truly points to the responsibility that employers have to actually evaluate and have a formal process for selecting a broker and consultant for their health benefits. Marilyn, can you summarize the DOL EBSA requirements that were stated in the 2021 guidance?
Absolutely. And actually, there are two recent developments I would like to mention in this regard. The first was a recent change in the law brought about by the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021, or the CAA, another law, Dorothy, you and I have spent a lot of time talking about because there's so many provisions in that matter to the administration of benefit plans. But there's a specific provision in the CAA that requires service providers, which could include brokers and consultants and TPAs and various other service providers, to make certain disclosures to employers about the services they are providing, as well as the fees and commissions they are receiving. So this new disclosure requirement is intended to provide more transparency so that employers have more information at their disposal when selecting and monitoring service providers. And second was the item you specifically referenced just now, and that is in 2021, the Department of Labor issued guidance placing more focus on the obligation of employers when administering their plans subject to ERISA to focus on cybersecurity. We all know about the HIPAA security rules, but this is an additional set of security rules that falls under the jurisdiction of the Department of Labor and under the auspices of ERISA. And as part of this guidance, the DOL emphasized the need to look for a service provider with strong cybersecurity practices, which the Department of Labor summarized in a document entitled Tips for Hiring a Service Provider with Strong Cybersecurity Practices.
Well named, yeah.
Well named, very, very good. In connection with cybersecurity, we also know that the DOL has started to ask about cybersecurity processes when it conducts audits. Finally, we also know that there has been a recent court decision that confirms that focusing on cybersecurity practices is a part of an employer's fiduciary responsibilities.
So you're saying, which again, we've talked about in great detail on prior webinars and this podcast as well, that there needs to be a formal process to compare and contrast, evaluate candidates and so forth. Is that correct? And do you think most employers are doing this?
I suspect most are not. Some employers do develop RFPs or checklists, and those documents may help the employer and the potential service provider focus on some issues critical to the selection process, but most probably do not and probably should consider that as part of their selection process.
Sue, what do you think?
I can almost guarantee that your smaller employers and their brokers are not aware of this at all.
And that's pretty scary. That's very scary. But it's the truth. It's the reality of the situation. People just don't pay attention. They may not subscribe to all the services, you know, that we do, that Maryland does and so forth. And that's why it's so great to have such a great resource that we have in having Maryland on retainer. She's just amazing and always helps us out. So
small employers have a lot on their plate. It's hard for them to juggle both operating their day-to-day business responsibility as well as their benefits plans. So they therefore look about for resources when new issues are identified for them.
Right, right, exactly. So Marilyn, what you're saying is that it's not always in the best interest of the plan participants, which of course ERISA regulates. It's always not in their best interest to select your golf buddy, your family member, your best friend. I'm not saying you can't, because there are certain circumstances when you absolutely can, but I'm saying that if you do, it should be for a valid reason after looking at other options, correct?
That is correct. So as a fiduciary under ERISA, the employer has a duty of undivided loyalty to plan participants and beneficiaries. This is referred to as the exclusive benefit rule, and the duty of prudence, also known as the prudent person standard. And these duties both apply to the selection of a service provider. As part of these duties, the employer cannot engage in a prohibited transaction with what they call a party in interest, unless it is allowed by an exemption authorized by the Department of Labor. We talked about that more in an earlier podcast. The new disclosure rules under the CAA are designed in part to ensure employers have some of the data they need in order to make decisions about plan service providers consistent with these fiduciary standards.
So in your opinion, how often should you look at the possibility of changing brokers and consultants? Sue, let's start with you.
Well, certainly if an employer is experiencing any type of drop in service or responsiveness, and this is very real, if they only see their broker once a year at renewal, it's time to seek out a partner that will be more attentive to the strategic and real needs they have. You know, with smaller employers, I don't know that there's any set schedule, but you should know what your needs are, right? If you have an HR person or if you don't. So they may be compliance related, it may be more transactional service or even strategic planning. So are you getting those needs met by your broker? If you're saying right now, I wish my broker and consultant did X, you know, one of the things that Marilyn mentioned or I mentioned, maybe it's time to start a broker search.
Yeah, for sure. Marilyn, what do you think?
Well, I'd say as a general rule of thumb, perhaps every 3 years is a good time to look at the performance of your service providers. But as Sue referenced there, facts and circumstances may appear to warrant a shorter review time, that you may identify certain factors which cause you to say to yourself, you know, I think I better look and see if there's better services, more strategic services, more hands-on services that are available out there. But keep in mind, even though you may decide to conduct a formal review once only every few years, monitoring is an ongoing process.
Yes, it absolutely is, and it's stated in many of these different reference materials that they provide for us. Let's talk about some employer compliance specifics. Marilyn, you and I recently did a COBRA webinar for TPA and some of our ABC clients, and we talked about what broker responsibilities were related to COBRA. What are those?
ERISA and many other federal benefits laws, such as COBRA, the Affordable Care Act, HIPAA, etc., place the legal obligation to comply on the employer, not on the insurance company, although they may also have, under some of these federal laws, obligations to comply, but employers separately are legally obligated to comply. A broker is not legally obligated to comply, but can absolutely help the employer by advising them, educating them, and guiding them and helping them find the resources they need to help implement these new and ongoing federal laws and regulations.
Let's talk about the ACA and the annual employer reporting. Whose responsibility is it to do the reporting and understanding the ACA overall? Is it the broker's responsibility or the employer's? And what role should a broker play in this? Marilyn?
Well, the legal obligation rests with the employer, not the broker, and not the insurer, although the insurer has its own responsibilities under the ACA. But the broker can provide guidance and assistance in this process by educating the employer and helping the employer find the right partners to satisfy the employer's reporting obligations. As you mentioned, Dorothy, we are doing a 2-hour webinar on February 7th, that will walk employers through the 2023 IRS forms 1094, 1095 reporting process.
Yeah, and we do those annually. We always bring Marilyn in February of every year when everybody's really working on their forms, and that's her baby. That's not mine. I openly admit that although I fully understand, because I have to, I choose to let Marilyn do all the explaining. I don't like anything that looks like a tax form. I'm sorry, even though I was a marketing and finance major, but even though I was a finance major, I don't like the look of tax forms. Marilyn does for some reason. She just loves working with those forms. So anyway, sorry about that. Sue, did you want to throw your 2 cents in on this?
Well, you know, in any of these instances where Marilyn is talking about the employer having the onus of responsibility, it's sort of a catch-22 for brokers who work with the smaller employers. Again, like I mentioned, the ones that don't have an HR department or don't even have the resources or the knowledge to handle their own filing any or meet any of these compliance issues we've been talking about. The employer may know they have a requirement, but they may be at a loss as to how to fulfill it. Brokers who are completely hands-off and don't assist their clients in these areas may lose their client to a broker who's willing to guide them, even though that broker has no obligation to do so. So it is sort of a catch-22. You may not want to have to do it, but you may have to do it to keep your client, fully knowing though that the responsibility is with your client.
Right, absolutely. And like I said, me personally, I don't really like dealing with the reporting, but again, we have to. This is our, just, I look at it like it's part of our job to educate. And Marilyn, you and I did many, right from the beginning of the ACA, we were out there doing, we did a tour all over California, basically talking to all of our clients. And that's before we had the days of Zoom, so everybody was in person. And we were actually had people pulling out calculators, remember that, and doing
Oh, yes.
Whether or not they should offer plans or not, and making sure that they understood it right from the beginning. So the Affordable Care Act has been in our wheelhouse since the beginning. But it's just the forms part that I like to say, okay, Marilyn, you go with it. You go ahead and explain all this. I don't choose to do that. I don't like to do that. She's better at it than I am. I'm not afraid to admit that that's my weakness. I don't like explaining tax related forms or anything that looks like that. Marilyn's good at it. I am not. So again, that's one of my weaknesses. The law, yes. How it applies, how it works, yes. I get kind of a a fuzzy thing over my eyes. You know, I get, it's just kind of, when I see tax forms, I just, ugh. Anyway, sorry.
I remember that. I remember that roadshow and the clients taking out the calculators very well.
Yeah, yeah. So right from the beginning, we were doing this before it was even actually implemented, but we were in the process of getting ready for it. So let's talk more about the CAA requirements for both employers and brokers and consultants. Marilyn, what are some of the responsibilities of employers under the CAA? And then we can talk about more of the broker role. Let's begin with the RxDC reporting requirements. Can you briefly summarize what those are and the difference between self-funded and fully insured employers? And you know, and what have you seen as far as brokers getting involved with RxDC reporting? I know that's kind of a mouthful, but let's try to break it down. Marilyn?
Well, sure. So under this mandate, which was a part of the massive CAA bill, which included a lot of mandates, but this particular one, the RxDC reporting, every year plans have to report to the government certain specific information about the costs of prescription drug benefits and healthcare spending under their plan. The disclosures are made through the CMS HIOS system, that's H-I-O-S system. And the disclosures are due every June 1 for the prior calendar year. Now, if your plan is fully insured and the carrier reports the data to CMS, the employer has nothing more to do. However, remember that first the carrier might need certain data from the employer before making the filing. And second, the employer should keep records of the carrier's commitment to file. So this means that if the carrier asks you for certain data so that they can complete the filing, which they may send out through a survey directly to the employer, don't ignore that survey. Fill out that survey so that the carrier has all the data it needs. If you ignore the survey, then the carrier can't do a full reporting and the employer will be legally obligated to make up the difference. Now, if your plan is self-funded, you are responsible for the filing, so you'll have to coordinate with your service providers to accomplish this. Dorothy and I put together a webinar and podcast on this topic to help employers understand their obligations and the applicable processes.
Yes, and that podcast is still available on our podcast platform, so you can go ahead and search that if you need to. Sue, what about you?
Well, Dorothy, this may sound scary, but I remember I was in a GA, so I actually knew of brokers whose clients missed the carrier deadline. So as Marilyn said, there were carriers that were willing to report the information for their insureds, but some of those clients I know have completely ignored the requirement. And then their brokers as well just completely ignored the requirement. And then I know on the flip side, I know of other brokers who like basically was all hands on deck and they used massive internal resources like the entire staff to make certain all their clients' information was transmitted to the carriers, taking the burden off of their clients. And then also that way the brokers knew, okay, I already reported everything to the carriers, my work is done. But we also know, and Dorothy, you may remember this from when we listened, sat in on some of those webinars, that depending on the state you were in, some of the carriers were saying they weren't going to report. So that was for a broker to just completely be hands-off in that situation really left their clients exposed.
Don't just assume, even if you've got a fully insured plan, that your carrier will comply with all these mandates. Many of them are, but not all of them are. So you need to know where your carrier stands on these issues. And even if they've agreed to comply, what the employer and the broker should do is keep records.
Yeah.
So that if they're ever audited later on, they can say, hey, our carrier promised to do that. And here's the proof.
Yeah. And we've talked about, Marilyn, you just mentioned it, but we've talked about this before on this podcast. And of course, we've done many webinars and seminars on this. But my company, Advanced Benefit Consulting, is, of course, an approved submitter in the HIOS portal, and we actually did all of the submissions ourselves for the self-funded employers that we have, our clients. Even though the TPA could have done them, we could have farmed that off to them, and our clients may have had to pay a fee for that. We chose not to because, A, I'm a control freak when it comes to compliance. I want to make sure it's done right. And B, that way it's, you know, we have everything. We have complete records. We can print everything. We can show our clients that this has been done. And I have the comfort of knowing that they've been fully, you know, compliant and taken care of. So we did that with the first set that was due on originally December 31st, which was pushed back until January. And then with the annual obligations, going on after that. So we'll talk more about that as we go through this. But the bottom line is that somebody has to do it, and you want to make sure that somebody is taking care of it for you. Another CAA requirement, of course, is the gag clause, prohibition and attestation requirement. Do brokers have a role here? And I have some comments on this one as well. Marilyn, why don't you start?
Well, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. The broker can educate, guide, and advise. The legal responsibility rests with the employer, but the broker can be a partner to them in this process. This new requirement was confusing to a lot of employers, and the communications they received from the carriers did not always help much. Sometimes they did, but not always. So a broker can help the employer understand what it has to do and what it doesn't have to do in order to comply.
Well, I'm going to go back to my catch 22 scenario. I would say if you're an employer listening right now and you have no idea what Marilyn just said and you're wondering what is this gag clause thing, then make a note to ask your broker to tell you. And if your broker is not sure, then I refer back to the previous question about maybe it's time to do a search.
Absolutely. And again, at ABC, we trained our clients that are employers, of course, teaching them what was involved. That was before you were hired, Sue. And of course, ABC, once again, we filed all the attestations for all of our clients, both fully insured and self-funded, even if their carriers say they were going to do it, because we wanted to make sure there wasn't any that were missed. So we actually, when we completed the spreadsheet and uploaded that, we included every one of our clients on that to make sure that that was done on time. And Sue, you were actually in attendance on more than one of those webinars and so forth over the last couple of years. We've talked about these topics. So you were actually in attendance when we were doing that education. So she was interested. As I said, she's a mini me. That's how I refer to her. She was, even as a GA, she was attending all of these things because she wanted to learn. She wanted to make sure that she could help people on the GA side so that they knew exactly what was going on. So again, mini me, mini me. So lastly on the CAA, let's talk about the CAA broker compensation disclosures. What does the broker have to do and how often?
Well, a service provider under the law, which would include a broker and consultant, must disclose to the plan fiduciary, which in other words is the employer, a summary of the services the vendor provides, as well as a summary of the fees and commissions it receives. And that's fees and commissions it might receive from a third party, such as an insurance company. The disclosures must be made on the date the contract is entered into, renewed, or extended. So basically in connection with the open enrollment period. And the disclosures must also be made upon request. So if an employer asks for the information, the service provider must provide it in a timely manner.
And it's not a one-time thing.
No, and I do get that question a lot. Was this a one and done right after the CAA came out? No, it's because you have to do it when the contract is entered into, renewed, or extended. It basically becomes more or less an annual requirement that before the open enrollment season, when the employer is selecting which plans it wants to go with, this is when that disclosure is going to be made.
Right. Right. What about Sue? What about you from the prior to this, the GA side of this? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so I think very few brokers are, let's see, overtly doing this. I think in some cases they're relying on the printed quotes, for example, because in the smaller group arena, they're set rates. They're relying on those to be some type of disclosure. I know that percentages were allowed, but I don't know of any brokers that I've talked to on the smaller side that are actually saying, oh yeah, no, I get this. I disclose this to my clients all the time. It's just, I think, being ignored in a lot of ways right now.
That's sad and scary. We're from the, because we do a lot of self-funding, of course, we grew up in the ERISA environment. So under ERISA, we've always had to make these disclosures. So this is absolutely nothing new to us, right? We're used to doing this. But yeah, small group, especially fully insured, they're just not used to it. And it's sad to say, you know, that so many aren't paying attention to this. But again, that's another reason that people should be looking at alternate brokers, perhaps.
I would also remind people that if you're a large employer and you file a Form 5500, you're probably used to getting certain disclosures through the Schedule A that comes from the insurance companies. This broker disclosure requirement that was put in place under the CAA is in addition to the Schedule A. The Schedule A doesn't satisfy the requirement in full, and it doesn't replace this new requirement.
And also, the CAA goes, it's not groups over 100 that file a 5500, it's all groups, it's all employers.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there's a
Exactly.
big gap there. There's a big gap. Yeah. So let's talk about employers as plan sponsors, okay, and plan administrators under ERISA. Are they legally responsible for plan documents and SPDs? Of course they are. So let's talk about this, whether they're fully insured and self-funded. Marilyn, talk us through this, and is there a role for the broker in this?
Absolutely. A broker can definitely help to facilitate this process, including by educating the employer and pointing the employer in the right direction if outside services are required. The proper plan documentation is essential. It is required by ERISA, and it is also essential for effective plan administration. Now, if you have a self-funded plan, the TPA may provide a plan document, an SPD, or both combined. However, the employer is still responsible for making sure these documents are created, updated, and satisfy all the legal requirements. If your plan is fully insured, the carrier will provide you with evidences of coverages, or also referred to as an EOC. And while these EOCs are absolutely essential documents which must be distributed to participants, they will not fully satisfy all the ERISA requirements. So employers need to supplement the EOCs they get from the carriers with what we call a wrap document. The broker can help with the process of preparing and implementing the wraps. The wraps, by the way, are also essential for Form 5500 purposes, but that's another topic for another day.
Yeah, Sue, what about you?
I'm going to sound like a broken record. If your employer listening right now and you have no idea what a plan doc is and you have no idea what an SPD is, I would say that's a red flag. Many brokers who don't do benefits full time can overlook these requirements, and there are a lot of brokers out there, especially that work with smaller employer groups, that don't do benefits full time, like Dorothy does, for example. She doesn't write property and casualty, or she's not a financial advisor on the side. So not to say that a broker that does those things doesn't know what they're doing, but if your broker is not a dedicated benefits broker, then you may not be getting all the boxes checked that you should be on a regulatory basis, including these types of documents. I had a conversation with an employer just last week, and I mentioned these things to them regarding their flexible spending account, and he said to me, okay, if you're noticing the overlook I have right now on my face, it's because you just freaked me out. So that was a great way to start a conversation about maybe it's time to work with somebody who does know what those things are. Because to Marilyn's point about all these requirements, the onus is on the employer. So if your broker doesn't do this for you, you can't really blame them when you're the one who's responsible. So in this area, employers can be extremely vulnerable and in the dark, and their broker may be in the dark as well.
Yeah, for sure. Well, this is one of the things, obviously, that we do, of course. We actually write plan documents, write summary plan descriptions. I do myself. I actually do them personally, and wrap documents for fully insured groups. As a matter of fact, Marilyn is currently working on an updated 2024 wrap document with us to make sure that we've got all the. There are always so many changes, right? So it has to be done not just once, but you have to pay attention to all the changes that have occurred. So, as things change, you need to review those again and make sure that they're all up to date because you're responsible for that. So that's something that, again, not all brokers do. I mean, they may, and I'm not saying that, there are a lot that do it. They may not do it themselves like we do. They may not be plan document writers, but that comes from my TPA background, right? Because I used to have to do that was my job, part of my job anyway. But they at least find resources for their clients. Okay, well, yes, you have to do this. Let me point you to this company to do it for you. We like doing them in-house when we can because we just want our clients to know that we understand this stuff and that we're preparing it on their behalf. And that way they can save the money too, that they don't have to pay an outside person to do. Although we do pay Marilyn, a retainer for her work when she helps us work on these. But it does save the client some money as well. So let's move on and talk about employer education in general. Is there any responsibility of a broker to offer education to its clients on all things benefit related, or is it just a great add-on service? Marilyn, we'll start with you.
Well, I would not describe it as an obligation, but it is a very valuable service brokers can provide. It can be difficult for an employer to access good information and education on employee benefit issues, so a broker that can lead the employer in the right direction provides a lot of value.
Yeah, Sue, what about you?
Well, it's a great question because, like Marilyn alluded to earlier, that a client has a business they engage in on a day-to-day basis. And so they don't do benefits every day like we do. And it's, you know, it's their responsibility to know their business. It's our responsibility to know our business. But the broker that helps the employer to understand all of these hoops that they have to get through, you know, based on the different regulations that are out there. Again, like we mentioned, that because the onus is on the employer, so it's not the responsibility of the broker. It would almost borderline be negligent for a broker to not educate their clients, that exposing them to all these types of issues that they're vulnerable when they don't have a broker that's educating. So it's our job to keep track of all things that are benefits related so that they don't have to.
Right. And I think you make a good point there because, again, it's definitely an add-on service. It's not a requirement and not all brokers are going to do this, but I think it's more of a moral and ethical responsibility to at least inform them that it exists. And even if you're not an expert as a broker, if you're not an expert on it, point them in the right direction to find resources to help them out. I think that's probably what you were alluding to, Sue, that, you know, it's this is our business. It's not theirs. So we need to help them out whenever we can. And again, that's my personal opinion. Marilyn may agree or disagree with me, but that's definitely my opinion. What are the most common types of education that brokers and consultants offer their clients? And what are some of the examples of some exceptional education of employers by brokers? Marilyn, let's start with you.
Well, I think these days what we see most often are, if education is provided, newsletters and webinars seem to be the most common resource out there.
And Sue?
Well, Dorothy, one of the reasons I wanted to join your firm is because you do these things. You provide newsletters, you provide webinars, you're, you know, even for those self-service type of employers that want to have the information on hand, but they want to consult it when they're ready to consult it. I know you record your webinars, they can have their newsletters in hand. So those types of easy access information, I think are vital for an employer, especially because if they don't think about it today, they may think about it tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so we want to make sure that they have the resource there so that they now know like what questions to ask, whether it's of us or their current broker.
Right. And we do make this a top priority. And we do have monthly seminars, webinars, or lunch and learn, something 9 months out of the year, because no one would attend in December or July or August. We've learned that the hard way. But you're right. We do record them all and we put them all on our on-demand education platform so that people can review them later. And also we're finding out that when our clients have new hires, someone new in human resources or payroll or whatever, they want them to go back and, oh, you did a great webinar last year on this. Is it available? Yes, it is. Go to the platform and get it. Our clients have a client-only section, which, of course, they can go in free of charge at any time and pull down any of those. Now, I can't say 100% of them get put up on there because sometimes there are technical difficulties. One thing I can say about technology is that it's great until it isn't. So sometimes we have a little glitch that might happen. But, you know, 95% of the time we've recorded them and posted them up there for clients. And when we are missing something, if someone has something that they need to know, we do make sure that we explain that to them. So that's just something that we do. Of course, we don't expect everybody else to do what we do, but that's what we do. Are there other ways that employers can learn about the laws and the regulations that apply to them, Marilyn?
Well, yeah, there are many HR organizations such as SHRM and PIRA locally that provide updates on not only employment law, but also benefits issues. And then there are some organizations such as IFEBP or the International Foundation or its subsidiary SEEBS, also referred to as ISCEBS, that just focus on benefits. Another thing that you can do that's fairly easy is you can subscribe to newsletters or updates from the Department of Labor and specifically their Employee Benefits Security Administration, EBSA, or the HIPAA side, you can subscribe to OCR's newsletters where you'll get updates on new and upcoming developments.
Well, thank you for that. Sue, did you want to provide any comments here?
We talked earlier about resources, and Dorothy, you're an incredible resource. I know that almost every magazine that I pick up in the HR and insurance world, you've got at least one article almost every month in them. But also, you know, the reality too is that employers hopefully can also learn about some of these laws and regulations through their brokers, and their brokers learn through associations that are in their industry, like Dorothy and I belong to, the National Association of Benefits Insurance Professionals. They also have a foundation side that educates the consumer level. So there are resources out there. You may have to look for them or ask your broker.
That's what I was going to say. Ask your broker where their resources point me in the right direction. Yep. And they should at least be able to point them in the right direction. And if they can't, again, that's another reason you might want to think, oh, red flag. But hopefully they'll help them with that. So how important is it to have a dedicated service team at your broker consultant's office, Marilyn?
I think it's very important. You need someone who knows your plan, knows your needs, and knows your workforce. A lot of benefit issues have to be resolved quickly and also involve a lot of moving parts. So someone familiar with your situation is in a better position to be responsive as well as resourceful.
And Sue, what about you?
So I would actually say it kind of depends. And this, remember, I tend to work with smaller employers. So sometimes, I hate to say this, but brokers don't know what they don't know. And so they're not sure if they're able to facilitate an answer for a question that a client may have. So while it's important to have someone dedicated to servicing the client, maybe on transactional issues, like I mentioned earlier, adding employee, deleting employee, those types of things, the employers may want to ask their broker, like, if they utilize additional resources, like we talked at the very beginning about a general agent. It could be that the employer has an issue that the broker may have a connection to the carrier, for example, to solve it, but they may have a GA that can actually speak directly to someone at the top. So it's important for a broker to know what their resources are and then make those available to their employer. So yes, it's important to have somebody in-house for some stuff, but maybe not for everything.
Thank you very much. So would you recommend a written checklist or an RFP list of questions that employers should be asking when they're looking for a new broker, or for maybe even just due diligence to see if their current broker is doing what they should be doing for an employer? Marilyn, what do you think?
I think that would be extremely helpful. That DOL guide on fiduciary responsibilities I mentioned earlier does recommend that when choosing a service provider, you compare apples to apples. A checklist is a great tool you can use to satisfy this recommendation.
Yeah, for sure. Sue, what do you think?
Well, absolutely. And we've put one together. I would call it a living document because it is going to be updated from time to time because we know the regulatory environment is ever changing. And so I think if an employer wants to know if their broker or consultant is looking out for their best interests, this tool could be helpful, but keep in mind, it's going to continue to be updated. So hopefully your broker is also updated.
You're right. And we will post our checklist as part of our show notes for this podcast. So you can definitely pull those down if you'd like to do that. It's a good working tool for you. And as Sue mentioned, we will update it from time to time. So you'll be able to see that in the show notes. So what do you guys think are the top five things that employers should be looking for in a broker consultant? Marilyn, let's start with you.
Let's see. Experience, expertise, responsiveness, transparency, and cost.
Good top five. Sue, what about you?
Mine are a little different. Expertise, transparency, attentiveness, humility, you know, if you don't know what you don't know, and honesty. I think one of my big things when I've worked with employers is the ability to say, I made a mistake, or to say, I'm sorry.
Right.
I like that list.
Yeah, I like both of your lists. Actually, they're both very, very helpful and very, very good. So thank you for that. I'm afraid that we're out of time, however, today. So thank you very much for being my guest today. I really appreciate both of you being here.
Dorothy and Sue, it was a pleasure chatting with you today, and let's do this again.
Well, thank you, Dorothy and Marilyn. I always love chatting with the two of you and being able to help clients and employers that are out there to find the best broker. I think, well, that's what I'm here for.
Absolutely. So, if anybody should want to reach out to you guys, how would they do that, Marilyn?
Well, you can reach me at my email address, Marilyn@monahanlawoffice.com.
And Sue?
Mine's really easy too. It's sue@advancedbenefitconsulting.com.
Great. Thanks, you guys. Well, thanks again to both of you. I really appreciate it. And to everybody listening out there, please stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned for the next episode of the Benefits Executive Roundtable. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for compliance tips, cost containment ideas, new trends, and decision-making tools. This podcast is produced by Advanced Benefit Consulting, Anaheim, California. All views expressed are those of the host or interviewees and not necessarily those of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Information contained herein should not be construed as legal advice. We always recommend that you consult with your legal counsel as situations do vary. Ms. Koshu can be reached at 714-693-9754 extension 3. Toll free at 866-658-3835. Or visit our website at advancedbenefitconsulting.com.